was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. FBI Director Christopher Wray on Tuesday defended the Bureau against criticism that it missed warning signs about the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol and failed to adequately sound the alarm about the possibility of violence by supporters of then-President Donald Trump. In his first congressional testimony since the riot, Wray disputed claims that far-left activists masquerading as Trump supporters were involved in a deadly attack. Testifying before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, Wray said the FBI took multiple steps to ensure that an intelligence report warning about the possibility of an attack on the Capitol building reached key law enforcement agencies before members of Congress met at the Capitol to certify Joe Biden as the winner of the presidential election. Yet the top officials responsible for security in the Capitol building said in congressional testimony last week that they had not seen the report prior to the rioting at the Capitol. That raises questions about a breakdown in intelligence sharing. Five people died in the violence at the Capitol, including a Capitol police officer. More than 100 officers were injured. Nationwide manhunt in the aftermath of the insurrection has led to the arrest of more than 270 people. U.S. President Joe Biden's pick to head the Office of Management and Budget, Neera Tanden, has withdrawn her nomination after she faced opposition from key Democratic and Republican senators for her controversial tweets. Tanden's withdrawal marks the first high-profile defeat of one of Biden's nominees. 11 of the 23 cabinet nominees requiring Senate approval have been confirmed, most with strong bipartisan support. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Dozens of pro-democracy activists returned to a Hong Kong courtroom Tuesday as their hearing on charges of subversion entered a second day. The 47 pro-democracy political figures, a broad cross-section of Hong Kong residents, faced formal charges of subversion under the city's new national security law. Hundreds of protesters defied social distancing laws to gather outside in support of those being tried. The first hearing for the 39 men and 8 women lasted more than 10 hours. And the hearing was eventually adjourned until Tuesday morning after one of the defendants collapsed and was admitted to a hospital. All of the other defendants were to be held in a detention center overnight. The global COVAX vaccine distribution effort delivered 11 million vaccine doses Tuesday to Angola, Cambodia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Nigeria. Last week, the West African nation of Ghana became the first to benefit from COVAX, receiving 600,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Ivory Coast also launched its COVAX vaccination program this week. Between now and the end of May, according to WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the COVAX facility will deliver 270 million doses to 142 participating countries and economies. The WHO project aims to deliver hundreds of millions of vaccine doses to low-income countries in the coming months, many of them in Africa. Top global health officials say these deliveries will be a turning point in the effort to stop the coronavirus pandemic. The global initiative, considered the world's largest, fastest, and most ambitious vaccine drive, was set up last April to ensure that poorer nations aren't left out of the worldwide scramble for vaccine access. Program is projected to cost about $11 billion, funded by donor nations, foundations, and private corporations. U.S. President Joe Biden has announced that thanks to a new cooperation between two drug companies, there will be enough doses of the coronavirus vaccination available for the entire adult population in the United States by the end of May. The president added, however, that it will take longer than that to inoculate everyone, and he urged people to remain vigilant by wearing masks. Mr. Biden had previously said that there would be enough doses by the end of July. On Tuesday, he said the faster production of the vaccine was in part the result of an agreement by the pharmaceutical giant Merck and to help manufacture the new Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine. The unusual agreement between rivals announced Tuesday was brokered by the White House. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Over 200 schoolgirls abducted last Friday in Nigeria have been freed.
There is no rejoicing where it is clear the dangers of kidnapping, of abductions and killings by bandits are still lurking around.
President Buhari is said to be pleased, but vows to shut down the abductors once and for all. Sudan welcomes the visit of the U.S. naval forces to Sudanese ports. UN appeals for millions of dollars for food assistance to refugees in Eastern Africa. And COVAX vaccine rollout spreads in Africa.
COVID-19 is a global problem. It requires a global solution. Unless every country is protected, no country will be safe. We all fell together. Let us all rise together.
Today is International Wildlife Day, and we'll examine threats to Kenya's wildlife. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Gunmen have released 279 girls who were kidnapped from a boarding school in the northwest Nigerian state of Zamfara, the governor said in a tweet on Tuesday. An armed gang abducted the girls from the government girls' science secondary school in the town of Jangebe on Friday. But as many rejoiced, rights activists warn caution.
The 279 girls were released around 3 a.m. local time and taken to government house in Gusau, the capital of Zamfara State. State Governor Bello Matawalle addressed the girls and said their release is a big relief to the state and their families. But the leader of the Bring Back Our Girls BBOG movement, Florence, also says the battle is not won if school children can still be attacked or kidnapped.
There is no rejoicing where it is clear the dangers of kidnapping, of abductions and killings by bandits are still lurking around. It is no longer a question of if school children or adults will be abducted, but a question of when.
Authorities say no ransom was paid to secure the release of the girls who were kidnapped last Friday during an overnight raid at their school in the village of Jangebe. Their abduction, resembling Boko Haram's 2014 abduction of 276 schoolgirls from Chibok in Borno State, triggered global condemnation with many leaders and groups calling for their release. State authorities say the girls will be treated for physical or psychological injuries before they are reunited with their families. Josephine Odumakin, a Nigerian women's rights activist and president of Women Arise for Change Initiative, says authorities should declare a state of emergency over the spate of abductions.
We must see the continual attack on our schools as a very dangerous trend that requires the country declaring a national emergency on security.
Nigeria is seeing a wave of kidnappings of school children by criminal gangs seeking huge ransoms. The kidnapping of the girls is the fourth such incident since December. Last week, President Muhammadu Buhari said his administration will not succumb to mounting pressure from criminal groups. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
A spokesperson says Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is pleased with the release of 279 schoolgirls abducted last Friday by gunmen in Zamfara State. However, Garba Shehu, the senior special assistant to President Buhari on media and publicity, says the president is determined to end once and for all the threat posed by non-state actors.
He expressed pleasure because that he felt much relieved that they have been freed without harm or loss of life. He's quite pleased with their release.
Shehu, how did the release come about?
Well, the process is in the domain of the state government, in this case, the government of Zamfara. The federal government controls the police and the army. The armed forces of Nigeria, the police, they have kept vigil over the territory, identified the location in which these girls were held, both by air and also by land. What it meant is that they were forced to be confined to a given location, but government did not authorize the use of force in order to avoid casualty. And they said they negotiated using repentant bandits who spoke to their colleagues in the forest and got the girls freed.
Was there any ransom paid?
The government of Zamfara State said they hadn't paid anything, and we believe them.
The frequency of the abductions, it seems to me this is a business now. Does the federal government or the government of Zamfara State know the identity of the abductors?
The federal government has given a serious warning to bandits to not misconstrue the government's desire for safe release of abductees for wickedness. No individual, no group is more powerful than the government in Nigeria. The government is ready to use force now against anybody, any criminal in the bushes found wielding dangerous weapons such as this AK-47 rifles. They'll be hunted down. There's no doubt about this one.
President Buhari has said that the recent abduction will be the last in Nigeria. What is the government willing to do to back up that statement?
Well, the minister who represented the president at that event, I think, did issue a clarification because such a magisterial statement could be seized upon by opponents. And in Nigeria, this is absolutely possible that opponents, whether they are political or non-political, can seize upon this to go and seize students from their hostels. I think what the minister meant to say, and perhaps he misspoke, was that the government is taking every measure, including now religious implementation of the Safe Schools Initiative, to ensure that school premises are secured against incidents such as this. But this can only be done in collaboration with the state government, the local councils, and religious organizations. In addition to that, of course, the new military commander was appointed have clearly been mandated to do whatever it will take to stop this recurring embarrassment to the country.
Shehu, thank you very much. It's a pleasure speaking with you always.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
Garba Shehu is the Senior Special Assistant to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on Media and Publicity. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. Sudan welcomed the visit of U.S. naval forces to Sudanese ports on Monday. The visit followed the docking at Port Sudan of two U.S. Navy ships late February aimed at building a partnership between the two countries' armed forces. Naba Muhideen reports from Khartoum.
Sudanese officials cheerfully welcomed the missile-guided destroyer USS Winston Churchill at Port Sudan Monday. In a news conference, the top commander of Sudan's naval forces, An-Nairi Hassan, described the visit as a momentous occasion. Hassan says Sudan is happy to receive the USS Winston Churchill destroyer. This visit is historic after 30 years of severed relations. The visit has big implications and represents the resumption of the Sudan-U.S. relationship and the return of the warship visits. The United States removed Sudan from its list of state sponsors of terrorism in December after nearly three decades of sanctions stemming from Sudan's support for Al-Qaeda leaders in the 1990s. Officers from the U.S. African Command visited Sudan 2 months after the Trump administration lifted the sanctions, and they expressed an interest in military-to-military engagement. The visit by the U.S. Navy began on February 24, when the first U.S. ship in decades arrived at the Sudanese port. The Director of Maritime Affairs for the U.S. Navy's Sixth Fleet confirmed the U.S. and Sudan's interest to build a partnership between the two countries' armed forces.
The reason I am here is because I want to learn more about your country and develop partnerships with your Navy. We have many shared values. I am honored and humbled by the progress that the Sudanese people have made over the last couple of years to work towards democratic principles. We support that. And that's part of why I'm here, to reinforce those values. But the main reason I'm here is to become friends with our Navy counterparts. And I look forward to the work ahead.
Simultaneous to the U.S. Navy visit, a Russian warship has docked at Port Sudan. Russia is waiting for Sudanese government approval to build its first Navy base in Africa. Neba Muhideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 3rd. Top global health officials and luminaries brief on the progress of the global COVAX initiative, which saw its first African landfall last week. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The world's largest, fastest, and most ambitious vaccine drive is ramping up. the head of the World Health Organization says, with 11 million vaccine doses arriving Tuesday in Angola, Cambodia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Nigeria. Between now and the end of May, said WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the COVAX facility will deliver 270 million doses to 142 participating countries and economies. The global initiative was set up last April to ensure that poorer nations aren't left out of the worldwide scramble for vaccine access. The program, which is projected to cost about $11 billion, is funded by donor nations, foundations, and corporations. It is part of the Access to COVID-19 Tools Accelerator, a global collaboration that works on development and production, as well as equitable access to tests, treatments, and vaccines. Last week, the West African nation of Ghana became the first to benefit from COVAX, receiving 600,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Among the first recipients were President Nana Akufo-Addo and his wife, Rebecca, who received their shots on national television Monday in what he said was an effort to boost public confidence in the vaccine. Akufo-Addo says he plans to have the rest of the country vaccinated by the end of the year.
The world has seen already the great value of the COVAX facility. COVID-19 is a global problem. It requires a global solution. Unless every country is protected, no country will be safe. We all fell together. Let us all rise together.
Tedros says while the vaccine deliveries are good news, he's thinking much bigger.
When the history of the pandemic is written, I believe that the ACT Accelerator and COVAX will be one of its standout successes. This is an unprecedented partnership that will not only change the course of the pandemic, but will also change the way the world responds to future health emergencies.
Officials say the next step is to bring vaccine manufacturing to Africa. Currently, most vaccines available to the continent come from the world's largest vaccine manufacturer, the Serum Institute of India. Akufo-Addo said Ghana is working on a plan to manufacture vaccines locally. And John Nkengasong, head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said the African Union will meet next month to discuss how to do this as a continent.
All of that speaks to the need for our own ability to stand up and say that we, as a people of 1.2 billion people, will continue to invest in our own health security, our economic security that increasingly is being threatened by COVID-19. It is in this perspective that we look forward to working with all countries that will be receiving this COVID vaccine to ensure that they are distributed effectively, provide the appropriate support from the Africa CDC and partnerships that will enable us to distribute these vaccines in a timely fashion.
This vaccine rollout, Nkengasong said, is the first step in a long journey. But in this voyage, he said, the African continent is finally keeping step with the rest of the world. Anita Paul, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The World Food Program and the UN Refugee Agency are appealing for $266 million to restore full food rations for more than 3 million refugees in Eastern Africa. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Millions of refugees in camps across East Africa are not getting enough to eat. UN agencies have been forced to cut food rations in countries across the region because of a lack of cash. The most dramatic situation is in Rwanda, where refugees are having their food rations cut by 60%. In Uganda, which hosts the largest refugee population in Africa, the World Food Program has cut its food assistance to 1.27 million refugees by 40%. Other countries affected by severe funding shortages include Kenya, Tanzania, South Sudan, Djibouti, and Ethiopia. WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says refugees depend on humanitarian assistance to survive. WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says refugees depend on humanitarian assistance to survive. He says ration cuts have many serious knock-on effects that go beyond the health consequences of being deprived of critical nutritional needs.
When food is in short supply, protection concerns, including sexual and gender-based violence, increases in the camps. And this can also serve to significantly escalate tensions even within hosting areas.
The UN Refugee Agency says people who do not have enough to eat are forced to resort to so-called negative coping mechanisms to survive. UNHCR spokesman Boris Cheshirkov says the cuts in food aid are having dramatic consequences.
Already the cuts in food rations and cash are forcing people to skip or reduce meals, to sell off their belongings, and the risks are growing, including of child labor and domestic violence. People are already feeling desperate, and we need the support to ease their hardship.
The UN agencies warn of growing risks if food rations are not fully restored. They include increased malnutrition and anemia, stunted child growth, and a myriad of protection risks. They say the COVID-19 pandemic is compounding problems for refugee families. They note lockdowns and measures to contain the spread of the coronavirus have wiped out the ability of families to support themselves and find a way to put food on the table. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today is International Wildlife Day in Kenya. Conflict between humans and wildlife as a result of population increase is now rivaling poaching, the usual threat to wildlife. However, the Kenya Wildlife Service says there was zero rhino poaching in 2020 because of the coronavirus pandemic travel restrictions imposed by the government. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, environmental destruction continues to be a threat to many species in Kenya and other African countries.
As the world marks Wildlife Day, with the theme being forests and livelihoods, sustaining people and planet climate change, the United Nations Development Program cites environmental misuse and loss, forest depletion, tourism market volatility, and wildlife crime as among the main challenges Kenya and other African countries are struggling with to safeguard its wildlife. Poaching has been the main threat to Kenya's wild animals. However, in a statement by the Kenya Wildlife Service, Director General John Waweru said that for the first time in 21 years, Kenya Wildlife Service reported zero poaching of rhinos in the year 2020. Speaking to VOA, Stevie Taylor, Chief Executive Officer, Conservation Alliance of Kenya, said that movement of illegal wildlife products and killing of animals in Kenya is still on the rise.
We've also seen a lot of increase in killing of animals for various parts. And we've also seen a lot of movement of wildlife products through Kenya. And so we've seen lots of movement of wildlife products illegally, either through the seaport or through the international airspace, even by road, moving to the demand countries across Europe, Asia, and also the Far East as far as China.
The Kenya Wildlife Service said that travel restrictions resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic contributed to the low numbers of wild animal poaching. Mr. Itella, however, says habitat destruction continues to be a threat to many species in Kenya.
Communities have played a very critical role in ensuring that forests survive, but also now because of the demand, particularly in hellscape for geothermal, we've also seen a lot of habitats for wildlife also destroyed because some of the strategies Kenya has adopted are not really clean as far as clean energy is concerned.
According to the United Nations, poaching is a persistent global problem with a great effect on the East African region. The international demand for ivory and rhino horn is fueling declines in the elephant and rhino populations in Kenya, Tanzania, and in Africa. Reynard Nyandira is a wildlife activist in Kenya. He says lack of accountability in the conservation sector is hurting the wildlife across the region.
There's no monitoring and evaluation system where we can actually gauge the performance of these policy documents or different biodiversity strategies. So that accountability mechanism really let the conservation sector and the policymakers really run away a lot.
Few days ago, three rare giraffes died after being electrocuted by low-hanging power lines in Soysambu Conservancy in Kenya's Rift Valley region, causing mixed reactions from Kenyans and environmentalists. Kenya's Ministry of Tourism and Wildlife is one of the top ministries that contribute heavily to the economic growth of the country. and conservation of parks, forestry, and wild animals will provide security and promote commercial and other activities for the purpose of achieving sustainable wildlife conservation. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojembo in Milwaukee, USA.
A new report aims to help young people all over the world make environmentally sustainable choices, both in their daily lives and their future career choices. The GEO6 report, sponsored by the United Nations Environment Program, was co-authored by young people around the world. One of the lead authors, Sarah Nyanwira of Kenya, spoke to Ricky Stryak about how she hopes the information can impact East Africa and beyond.
Sometimes as a young person, especially working in the environment and considering all the challenges that we are currently having that originate from how we use our environmental resources, sometimes it feels like you are the only person who is concerned or who is being affected by this. And then getting to meet older people, scientists who are established, people who have expertise, and them advising us and giving us encouragement, interacting with us, listening to us, it encouraged us, it inspired us, it gave us motivation. And then having our voices heard, appreciated, and even being told what you feel is impossible is possible.
And the report aims to define how youth can bring about change by creating and accessing environmentally sustainable jobs. What did that look like in Kenya or East Africa specifically?
We have the ocean, the Indian Ocean. I've had a chance to talk with many young people and tell them the Indian Ocean has the capacity to employ so many young people in the coastal region. But the young people don't believe in that because they have seen their parents struggle to raise them up on these resources. And so it's usually a paradox in terms of, well, the environment is very rich. The way we've been using the environment has actually resulted to more negative impact than positive impact. And so the conversation has been, how do we create business enterprises? How do we come up with innovative ideas? How do we come up with approaches so that we are able to make use of the environmental resources that we have and properly use them sustainably, such that even now when the rains have not come during the right time.
Another aim of the report said it was going to identify sustainability actions that can, quote, change market dynamics. And that's something else I wanted to ask. It's one thing to identify environmentally sustainable jobs, but what about consumption habits?
Many young people felt that they are not able to contribute anything because they feel locked out. And we asked them, do you feel that you can influence policies on environment? And 45% or close to half of them said no. They feel they do not have the capacity. But what we realized during the writing of the report is education will be one of our core ways of changing the way we use now our environmental resources. Education in terms of making sure that environmental resources become a common topic. They are not only for the reserve of conservationists or people who work in the environmental sector, but then this language is being spoken by people who want to be architects, they want to be doctors. Doing this will be to ensure that from the beginning in our lower education, we introduce the topic of how do we use our environmental resources.
That was Sarah Nyanwira, a lead author of the new GEO6 report from the United Nations. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Nairobi, Kenya. And that's it for this Wednesday, March 30 edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington saying, have a great day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndumbulu and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey,
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.